impunity for Israel and the international legal system, but also in this field. And therefore, we see this kind of denial reproduced today, and we saw it in this event that I wrote about.
Professor, I wanted to just end by asking you about what just happened at the American Historical Association. I saw you a few weeks ago here in New York at the Hilton when members of the group voted overwhelmingly, 428-88, to oppose Scholasticide in Gaza. If you can talk about what happened next. I was talking to a past president of the American Historical Association. They said, oh, I'm sure they're going to have to go along with that vote because it was so overwhelming. But they vetoed it. We have 20 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, the AHA Council unfortunately vetoed this vote. Of course, this is, you know, an insistence on defending Israel at all costs. I think that what we're seeing, of course, is U.S. institutions standing behind the defense of Israel, because if we come to terms with what Israel is doing, which is Israeli settler colonialism, this then means that the settler colonial genie is out of the bottle. We have to talk also about settler colonialism here in the U.S.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you so much for being with us. Professor Raz Siegel, Israeli-American historian, expert in Holocaust studies. We'll link to your Jacobin piece. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland. Listen,
laugh,
learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
What is climate change? How is it affecting our lives? And what can we do about it? We'll connect the dots from energy to extreme weather, public health, and more. I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz. Join me for Climate Connections during the evening news. Weekdays at 5 p.m. here on 90.7 KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal judge blocks Trump's order to freeze billions in federal spending, for now. Oregon lawmakers consider a bill to pivot public employees' pension funds to the green economy, and undocumented Oregonians could receive better access to food benefits. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 28, 2025. I'm Althea Billings. A federal judge in D.C. has blocked Trump's order to freeze some $3 trillion in federal grants and loans until at least February 3rd. Trump says the freeze will be so his administration can review where money was being spent and if they agree with it. Nonprofit Democracy Forward filed the lawsuit, and separately, 22 state attorneys general plan to sue as well. They claim that the order violates the First Amendment and the constitutional clause that gives Congress broad authority on how to spend taxpayer money. The separation of powers in the U.S. government means the White House usually does not have authority over spending. A 1974 budget law allows for the White House to temporarily delay funds, but only within a certain procedure, not just because the president doesn't like it. Earlier today, the online portal where states are reimbursed for Medicaid went down, as did the ones for preschool providers to be reimbursed in the Head Start program and reimbursement for housing providers. A freeze for federal spending on assistance programs would have wide repercussions for everyday Americans and the projects in their communities. These include programs to feed poor families with children, to fund schools and health insurance for a fifth of Americans, grants for local law enforcement, recovery support for Americans impacted by natural disasters like hurricanes and wildfires, funding for infrastructure projects, charitable organizations, and more. The lack of clarity on what programs would be impacted and how threw state and national leaders, local agencies, and nonprofits into disarray today. Relatedly, the independent tech journalism site 404 Media found that memos sent by the Trump administration to federal workers were seemingly written by people employed by conservative think tanks like the Heritage Foundation. They're also notably the authors of Project 2025. 404 Media examined the metadata in these documents and found that the authors failed to scrub that data, revealing the authors of those memos. Project 2025 is the right-wing agenda that Trump's team appears to be following, despite disavowing the document on the campaign trail. It promises to fire federal workers, to install conservative right-wing figures, restrict access to reproductive care, and carry out mass deportations. A separate email from the White House earlier today offered federal employees the opportunity to quit their jobs now and be paid through the end of this September. It's part of an effort by the Trump administration to shrink the federal workforce and will likely result in the work of the federal government being slowed down and expertise being lost. The Trump administration continues to carry out large-scale deportation efforts that were promised on the campaign trail. Trump is now willing to detain people at sensitive locations, ones that were off limits to such raids during his first term. That includes churches, and parish leaders are discussing how to navigate the evolving situation. Mike Mullen has more in Minnesota.
The mass deportation plan promised by President Donald Trump shows no signs of slowing down after his first week back in office. Church leaders in Minnesota and elsewhere renew their calls for places of worship to be off limits. A key difference between ICE raids under the new administration and those in Trump's first term is that a rule was revoked this month to no longer consider churches and schools sensitive locations. From 2011 until now, they were largely shielded from agents entering the site in pursuit of an undocumented person. Nicholas Tangen is with the Minneapolis Area Synod, which supports local Lutheran parishes, and he worries about the potential impact on congregations.
It may have a really chilling effect for folks in our communities, not just Christians, but folks of all faith backgrounds. It might prevent folks from attending religious services or going to places of worship, places where they've found comfort and safety and community for so long.
Tangen echoes arguments about the trauma families might experience when a relative is detained in these settings. For now, his team is trying to limit false rumors while reminding congregants about their rights. ICE agents still need a judicial warrant before entering a private area of a church. The Department of Homeland Security emphasizes that enforcement teams are being trusted to use common sense. Lutheran church leaders say they remain committed to supporting migrant children and families, adding it's a long-standing Christian mindset to, quote, welcome the stranger. Tangen says human dignity shouldn't be lost in the broader debate over immigration policy.
I don't think anybody should have to live in such profound fear that there are no places where they can find respite.
Immigrant advocates also worry the scope of these deportations will deter people from getting medical care they need or kids from attending school. In a statement announcing the rule changes, DHS officials noted they're empowering agents to enforce immigration laws and, quote, catch criminal aliens, including murderers and rapists, who have illegally come into our country, unquote. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
A bill in the Oregon legislature would redirect the investment of public employees' pensions away from fossil fuels. Oregon Bill 2200 is aimed at reducing Oregon's public employee retirement system's carbon footprint. It increases investments in green energy and climate-related projects, and also requires the state treasurer to submit biennial reports to the legislature for increased transparency. PERS is the name of the state pension and investment plan, and it covers more than 390,000 current and retired state, school, and local government workers. Currently, PERS' overall portfolio is about $94 billion, and it pays out more than $400 million in retirement benefits every month. Oregon State Treasurer Elizabeth Steiner says climate change threatens the long-term performance of the state's PERS funds. Steiner said, quote, going forward, we will keep our investment strategies up to date with the evolving climate science and the emerging growth opportunities the transition to clean energy offers, end quote. As of 2021, about $3.6 billion, or 3% of the overall PERS fund, was invested in fossil fuels. Steiner says it's her job to ensure that benefits are paid and that they can reduce the burden on current public employees paying into the fund. Since 2016, PERS investments in green energy transition infrastructure have increased by 20%. Steiner said, quote, the problem is that for some people, it's hard to dissociate divesting from carbon-intensive businesses. It's the right thing to do for the climate, and we are doing this bill because it's the right thing to do to protect the pension fund, end quote. The Treasury team is still paying attention to the profits carbon-intensive businesses like fossil fuel companies, pipelines, and refineries could return in the next 4 years. They recognize market forces may be different under the new presidential administration. Steiner is also asking for a budget increase to hire more staff. She wants to expand expertise to be ready for market changes. Data shows hunger across Oregon has climbed in recent years, and Latino communities are disproportionately impacted. A new bill would extend food benefits to undocumented children and older adults across the state. Isabel Charlet has more.
In the face of rising hunger across the state, new legislation would extend food assistance benefits to undocumented children and older adults. Recent data shows one in six kids in Oregon and Southwest Washington face food insecurity, with rates growing twice as fast in rural communities. The Food for All Oregonians bill is part of a broader immigrant justice package backed by a coalition of over 155 organizations. Andrea Vanessa Castillo with the Oregon Latino Health Coalition is part of the steering committee.
Despite working on farms that grow much of the nation's food, the Latina community members are facing barriers that perpetuate these cycles of food insecurity.
The bill would create a new state-run program similar to the federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, run by the U.S. Department of Human Services. Castillo points to 2023 USDA data showing nearly a quarter of Latino households had at least one member who faced food insecurity. Castillo adds this bill is about preventing health problems that come with not having access to healthy or traditional food.
We want to keep people from getting to this space by having access to foods that not only make people feel joy from eating, but that contribute to the nutrition in a very culturally specific way.
Oregon Food Bank saw record visits last year across the state, up over 30% from 2023. Only children and older adults would qualify for food assistance under the new bill, and the coalition hopes to expand the benefits to all undocumented Oregonians in the future. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Multnomah County wants to rebuild its animal shelter after years of failing audits and allegations of animal mistreatment. But County Commissioner Megan Moyer is surprised that it could cost up to $85 million to build the county's animal shelter. Original estimates put the cost at $65 million. Moyer says, quote, I'm not questioning the need for the new animal shelter, but as a former general contractor who built commercial property, I'm a little bit sticker shocked by the estimated amount of money, end quote. Facilities and Property Management Division Director Dan Zalko emphasized that the forecasted costs are based on concepts for the new facility, which would be double the size of the current 18,000 square foot shelter in Troutdale. He says the estimates will change again when the county decides where and how the new shelter will be built. Staff, auditors, and volunteers have long raised concerns about the county's existing animal shelter. Reports of deteriorating conditions and poor treatment of animals led to a 9-month review, and from that, there were more than 100 recommendations for improvement, including needing more space. With limited space, Animal Services Director Aaron Grayheck says, quote, the back halls are always cluttered with storage of supplies and equipment due to lack of adequate space. Our current examination and surgical spaces are cramped with inadequate kennels for pre- and post-operative management and monitoring for the range of species and volume of surgeries we're required to perform, end quote. The county is looking into several options to fund the shelter project, including from a voter-approved bond or from grants and loans. President Donald Trump considers dismantling FEMA. Scott Bessent becomes the next Treasury Secretary, and the North Carolina Supreme Court ballot saga continues. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Frankly, FEMA is not good. I think when you have a problem like this, I think you want to go, and whether it's a Democrat or Republican governor, you want to use your state to fix it and not waste time.
After surveying natural disaster damage, President Donald Trump signs an executive order aimed at FEMA. The order doesn't break up the emergency agency and give that role to the states, as Trump says he wants to, but Republicans, including the president, have criticized FEMA, even repeating the conspiracy theory that money for Hurricanes Milton and Helene recovery was spent on migrants. Trump is also repeating misinformation about California's water policies and joining those in Congress who want to tie fire relief to loosening environmental rules. State water watchers say his new executive order would override state environmental protections by sending more water south from Northern California. Bruce Resnick with the nonprofit LA Waterkeeper says that would mean taking advantage of the fires to benefit water-hungry corporate farms. He says LA already gets plenty of water.
In LA County, we import about 700 million gallons of water a day, about the 1.2 billion gallons we use. We flush it, we treat it again, and then we dump 450 to 500 million gallons of that back into the ocean.
A separate plan from local officials could help the LA area by aiding the county, the city, and the water district to reclaim hundreds of millions of gallons more of used water per day. The Senate confirmed Scott Bessent as Treasury Secretary in a bipartisan 68-29 vote. The first thing he'll have to deal with is raising the debt ceiling. The Treasury Department began taking extraordinary measures on January 21st and may stop paying into health, disability, and retirement funds for various federal employees. In the longer term, Bessent says he wants to look into creating an external revenue service that collects tariff revenues. Meanwhile, the North Carolina Supreme Court election saga continues. The Republican challenger, Judge Jefferson Griffin, wants 60,000 overseas ballots thrown out. He's arguing those voters did not present ID required for in-state voters when registering, even though that rule didn't apply to them. The race is still uncertified, and Jennifer Rubin with the North Carolina League of Women Voters says trying to get rid of properly cast ballots in an attempt to overturn a loss erodes confidence in elections in the state and beyond.
These kinds of actions sow distrust in people's minds in the election process. And it also should be a real alarm for North Carolina voters that something like this could happen.
Three recounts have all found Griffin lost, but only by about 700 votes. Connecticut advocates want lawmakers to strengthen the state's Trust Act, which limits how much local law enforcement can help with federal immigration actions. The new White House is threatening any state or local officials who don't cooperate with planned deportations, and critics charge the Trust Act would make Connecticut a sanctuary for immigrants who commit crimes. Supporters say that distorts how the law actually works, and they worry the Laken Riley Act, passed by Congress, which mandates detention for illegal immigrants arrested on minor charges, could also impact the Trust Act. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you?
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 31 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 49. Today in history, in 1935, Iceland becomes the first Western country to legalize therapeutic abortion. The quote of the day is from Cuban nationalist poet José Martí, born today in 1853. He wrote, quote, "Freedoms, like privileges, prevail or are imperiled together. You cannot harm or strive to achieve one without harming or furthering all." President Trump freezes federal grant and loan programs, including ones that go towards green energy projects in rural Alaska. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. More than $130 million in grants for clean energy projects in rural Alaska are now frozen. That's after President Donald Trump signed dozens of executive orders during his first day in office, including one freezing funding from the Federal Inflation Reduction Act and bipartisan infrastructure law. The projects were meant to lower energy costs in rural communities and bring them additional revenue sources to support critical infrastructure that includes hydroelectric dams, wind turbines, and solar energy systems that were funded in more than a dozen Alaska villages with federal grants throughout last year. Now, those projects are in limbo. One example is two large wind turbines in Kotzebue. Chad Nordlum is the energy project manager for the village. He says that with the funding freeze, residents are now concerned about the shipping schedule for the turbines and getting the project off the ground.
Right now, there doesn't seem to be much we can do on our end. We're just waiting for clarity.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has partnered with tribes across the state, including in Kotzebue, to receive the federal grants. In total, they've been awarded contracts for about $132 million, says Katya Karankovich, a project manager at the consortium, but they have not received the money yet. She says that the energy from those projects is cheaper than transported diesel and would help residents lower their bills. The tribes would also be able to sell that power to local utility companies and get additional revenue to invest in local water and sewer infrastructure.
We're trying to get all off-the-road system communities on board with the idea to do renewable energy in a completely different way in the state, and that is to set up the communities themselves to sell power to themselves and to use the earnings for public benefit, like taking care of sanitation infrastructure.
Karankovich says the projects in question are at different states of progress, but all have completed feasibility studies proving their cost efficiency. She says that while the funding freeze is a hurdle, the consortium still plans to continue moving forward with the projects. The funding freeze is also impacting Indian Country plans to improve roads, provide clean drinking water, clean up oil and gas wells, and other projects for tribal communities across the country. The nation's highest court has declined to hear a case about Montana voting laws that tribes and Native vote advocates say would have disproportionately affected Native people. Kathleen Shannon has more.
Last year, Montana's Supreme Court decided that two laws passed in 2021 to ban same-day voter registration and paid absentee ballot collection were unconstitutional. Alex Wright with the ACLU of Montana says people who face too many costs to voting often don't. For those who already face barriers, like long distances to elections offices or no residential mail delivery, these laws could have tipped the scales. Wright argues that was the intention.
That's what we saw with these laws, was a very deliberate attempt to make it so difficult for people to vote that they would stay home.
Montana Secretary of State Kristi Jacobson brought the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, which last week opted not to hear it. Wright says the high court doesn't have jurisdiction to pick up a case on state voting laws. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, states passed almost 80 restrictive voting laws between 2021 and 2024, nearly three times the number passed in the previous few years. So far in Montana's 2025 legislative session, a half dozen voting-related bills have been introduced by lawmakers, all Republicans. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
More than a dozen indigenous communities welcomed back more than 500 bison last year to their ancestral grazing lands across the country. The indigenous-led effort, which includes the Intertribal Buffalo Council, says bison play a role in spiritual and cultural revitalization and food sovereignty for indigenous people. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Cargo trucks cause a lot of pollution, but electrifying them could help. At the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach in California, a coalition plans to lease electric trucks and offer affordable charging. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Every day, thousands of trucks move cargo from the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach to warehouses. Most trucks run on diesel, which produces pollution that harms people's health and warms the climate.
Globally, heavy-duty trucking is responsible about 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions. That is not insignificant. That's a big deal.
Adam Browning is with the company Forum Mobility. He says switching to electric trucks could limit that pollution. But electric trucks have a high upfront cost, and trucking companies need to know they'll have a place to charge the trucks before investing in them. So Forum Mobility is partnering with the coalition Climate United to bring electric trucks and chargers to the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Using a grant made possible by the Inflation Reduction Act, Climate United will buy up to 500 electric trucks in bulk at low cost and lease them to trucking companies. Forum Mobility will then offer those trucking companies a subscription for access to convenient charging depots.
It's a 1-2 partnership for both the truck and the charging together.
Making California's trucking industry healthier for people and better for the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
It's been a little over a week since the ceasefire in Gaza started, and the Israel-Hamas deal has many obstacles. As one observer notes, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government seems committed only to stage one, leaving open the strong possibility of renewed fighting and prolonged Israeli occupation. He says Donald Trump seems fine with that. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The Israel-Hamas ceasefire has brought a measure of relief to Israelis and Palestinians, but everyone recognizes that what comes next is the real question. Next, that is, assuming the prisoner-hostage exchanges proceed as agreed upon. That is a big assumption. Will the ceasefire last? Will Gaza be free of Israeli occupation forces? There are plenty of reasons for concern, including the following. The exchange of prisoners for hostages may bog down over numbers, especially on the Palestinian side. As many as 10,000 prisoners are being held in Israeli Defense Forces camps, as well as other detention centers. Many prisoners have never been charged or sentenced, including children. How many prisoners there actually are, where they are, and whether Israel will release them are potential stumbling blocks. Next, Prime Minister Netanyahu is only fully behind stage one of the deal, a ceasefire and the exchanges. Stage two calls for a permanent cessation of hostilities and the complete withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. But according to Yossi Fuchs, Netanyahu's chief of staff, the deal includes the option to resume the fighting at the end of phase one if the negotiations over phase two don't develop in a manner that promises the fulfillment of the war's goals, military and civil annihilation of Hamas, and a release of all hostages. Let's recall that Netanyahu has never committed to anything short of total victory over Hamas. Even if agreement is reached on stage two, the devil will be in the details. Ivo Dalder, a former U.S. foreign affairs official, writes, quote, "Who will govern the territory? Who will pay for rebuilding a landscape reduced to rubble? Who will feed the people, house them, put them through school, get them jobs, treat their diseases, wounds, and emotional traumas, and criminals preying on the vulnerable and weak?" Governing Gaza could be the source of another conflict, this one between Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Hamas. Although Hamas has been seriously weakened, its cells still command authority and will probably reject a Palestinian Authority attempt to govern. One Middle East expert group writes, quote, "PA President Mahmoud Abbas's office stated on January 17 that the Palestinian Authority holds legal and political jurisdiction over the Gaza Strip as the recognized governing authority of the Palestinian territories and is prepared to deploy administrative and security teams to the Gaza Strip. However, the ceasefire does not task the Palestinian Authority with governing the Strip, nor does the ceasefire discuss post-war governance in any capacity. Left out of this commentary is Netanyahu's long-standing opposition to Palestinian Authority rule in Gaza. Hamas, in fact, has been rebuilding its numbers, even as its organizational strength has been seriously weakened. U.S. intelligence just now is reporting that Hamas has recruited around 15,000 people, even as it is said to have lost 20,000 fighters. Israel has frequently said Hamas must not be allowed to rise again. That goal would seem to be unrealizable. Israel's efforts to redraw the lines in the West Bank, southern Lebanon, and Syria are not addressed in the agreement. The far right in Israel will be insistent that the Israeli Defense Forces not withdraw from any of those occupied lands for security reasons. If the IDF remains there, we are bound to see more violence from Hezbollah, Syrian militia, Israeli settlers. Hezbollah is demanding that the IDF complete its withdrawal from Lebanon in accordance with their 60-day ceasefire agreement last November. That agreement has now expired. The IDF is saying it will not meet the deadline. And finally, ongoing violence in the West Bank, mainly by rampaging settlers and with support from Netanyahu's far-right ministers, could undo progress in the Gaza negotiations. Israel's far right is strongly against the ceasefire and is surely looking for ways to sabotage it. The New York Times reported January 21st that in the West Bank, quote, settlers rampaged through several villages, torching homes and businesses and vandalizing vehicles. One Israeli human rights group called the attacks pogroms intended to sabotage the ceasefire agreement. In fact, settler violence has been going on in the West Bank for months. In short, the ceasefire deal may amount to no more than stage one, leaving the Israeli Defense Forces still deployed in Gaza as well as in southern Lebanon, Hamas still actively recruiting, and the Palestinian population unable to resume their lives with any semblance of security and well-being. The Trump administration will support continued Israeli occupation, repression of the Palestinian population, obstruction of Palestinian self-government, and support of Netanyahu should he decide to resume fighting. Trump's appointment of ardently, indeed religiously, pro-Israel ambassadors to the UN and Tel Aviv, his voiding of Biden's sanctions on violent settlers, his order to the Pentagon to release 2,000-pound bombs for delivery to Israel, and his exemption of Israel from a decision to halt all foreign aid, all make clear that a just, peace-promoting settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is impossible under this administration. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 28th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Ed Travaglia, Josh Salem, and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Edwin J. Vieira, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.